John Papagiorgio of Papa's Basement here. I know we typically do a comedy talk format for the show, but I had a great guest on, Mike Sachs, author of Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. The dude was funny as hell. He couldn't have been nicer. And the interview ran about an hour, so I figured, what the hell? We are just going to make that the whole show. For those of you out there who consider themselves students of comedy, Mike's book is amazing. The guy really talks with some of the best that have ever put a pen to paper. James L. Brooks, Mel Brooks, Adam McKay, Paul F. Tompkins, Bill Hader, Bruce Vilanch, for God's sake. The dude got some people for this. If you are into the thought of ever breaking into comedy yourself, I also can't recommend the book highly enough for that. It reads like a how-to manual for doing exactly that. It is now time to bring on author of great renown, Mike Sachs. The man has written for Vanity Fair, Esquire, GQ, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Post, Vice, Maxim, and Mike, Women's Health. I have to ask about that.
Yeah, that was about my erectile dysfunction that I used to suffer at summer camp at Camp Erie in Maryland. No, that was about, I forget what that was about, but I thought I would get a female perspective in there because there's so few in my resume that I thought I would put that in to impress.
I like it. Dabbing the tears of disappointment.
Not from me, you're not.
Mike has also cranked out a lot of books, and good books, not e-books, real books. You've got, and here's the kicker, Conversations with 21 Humor Writers About Their Craft, Your Wildest Dreams Within Reason, and the book that I managed to snag a copy of and that I've been kind of stuck to ever since, Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. And, Mike, I just want to thank you before we begin for coming on the show. I don't know if it's because you're from the area or you have the Greek wife. I'm just going to exploit the hell out of whatever it is you see here.
No, you know what it is, really, is anyone from Northern Virginia or D.C. that's a comedy fan I love, because when I was growing up, I felt kind of alone. All my friends weren't really into what I was watching. It was all based out of New York and L.A., and to grow up as a comedy fan in D.C. Was kind of interesting. So anyone who's a huge fan from anywhere, but especially from D.C., always intrigues me.
Well, I have to, what age are you exactly? I want to know if we kind of came up at the same time. Or
no, I'm 45.
45, okay. So do you have any memories whatsoever of Don and Mike in the area?
I love Don and Mike. In fact, I was just on Rob Spiewak's podcast.
You have no idea how happy you have made me.
I'm a huge fan of Don and Mike. And actually, there were some people, I forget who it was, they got into the business. They're successful now, and they were on Don and Mike, and they were fans of Don and Mike, but for some reason they turned their back on Don and Mike, which I don't understand. Maybe it's because it was a D.C. thing, even though they were syndicated, but no, I'm huge fans of theirs. I thought they were amazing.
Okay, good. I grew up obsessed with them, and I think that was maybe the first time I realized I was like a slavish devotee of comedy, if it was in the right form.
I think they're one of the best things that that area has produced. I mean, consistently great, and it sort of imploded towards the end for various reasons, I guess, but that chemistry was amazing. But also the podcasts that are being done now are still fantastic. I mean, there's daily podcasts, there's a ton of stuff that you should check out. It's still great, so it's not as if we should talk in the past tense. They're doing great stuff still, which I listen to.
Really? The new, well, I guess it's not on Realm anymore, but the new Don and Mike show, or Don show?
Well, no, yeah, no, it's the yeah, the Don Geronimo is gone, but it's the Mike O'Mara show that's on the he has his own syndicate now, a syndicated podcast. Yeah, I mean, it's, both of those guys are just amazing, and I kind of miss driving around listening to those guys.
Oh, talk does not exist like that on air, period, anymore. I could do a 20-minute segment on that, how it was all doomed by Janet Jackson pulling out her breast and the FCC fines increasing. And
yeah, I don't know what happened. I mean, that used to be a full schedule. They used to have an amazing schedule, the Sports Junkies, and then they had, at one point, G. Gordon Liddy. I don't know if you were listening to it at that time, which was insane.
Yes.
But I loved the guy. He was really likable.
He was.
And then, of course, Don and Mike. So that was like a full day, and this is pre-podcast, obviously. But
don't forget
listening.
The Grease Man, sir. Do not forget the Grease Man.
Ooh, Doug Track, the Grease.
How about you, Gee?
Double-de-doo. Yeah, I never really got into the Grease Man.
Me neither, but I can always I love impressions of him.
Yeah, and how he got into some trouble always kind of disturbed me. What he was.
It was always the same thing that got him in trouble, too. His humor always took a certain path.
That's what bothered me. I mean, it was so specific. It was very uncalled for jokes about racism that were just horrible. And they were very consistently racist.
Yeah. I pictured a lot of doodles in the margin of every paper he had.
Yeah, I would hate to see those hangman nooses that were in the margins of that. But what was strange, too, was that it was always on time delay. So, like, it wasn't as if he knew he messed up. It was only later, like, he would receive, you know, all these calls, like, what? What did I do? What would I say about Martin Luther King?
Yeah, F you, sir.
Squibba-da-doo.
I could do an interview of nothing but Grease impressions with you, but I don't know if that would
well,
go at all.
Well, wasn't he at, didn't he, he left DC 101, or he was fired, I guess, and he went to 94.7, was it? And then he was on, wasn't he broadcasting from his basement in Potomac from one point for AM radio?
My claim to fame, when I initially started my very, very mediocre radio career, my first station was a pay-to-play station. And Grease Man had been reduced to recording at home and then showing up at our studio with tapes to get played.
Oh, well, what did he need that for? That's what I don't understand. The guy made a lot of money. He had a house in Potomac. Why did he need to go around, you know, as the equivalent of selling cassettes out of your trunk? I mean, like, what does he need at that point to be on the air so badly?
I have no idea. It's weird. I'm like you. I didn't care for him, and yet so many people in the industry that I respect the hell out of really view him as a sound broadcaster fundamentally. They all crapped all over him on air, and yet Stern, Don and Mike, I even want to say Opie and Anthony, after the fact, if they're interviewed about Grease Man, they will all doff their cap to the man.
Yeah, they never doffed it while they were competing.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no.
But, you know, I remember driving to work. I used to work at Kent Mill Records and other places in the area.
Oh, God, you are going deep, dude.
Oh, yeah.
I
worked there for 10 years in various places, Aspen Hill, Wheaton, Gaithersburg. But, you know, I would drive to work, and especially in the summer when the windows were open, I would always see, especially blue-collar trucks and stuff, people going to do painting jobs or whatever, they're always blasting Grease Man. That was hugely popular. And that's one of the things I miss now about satellite radio, is that you don't really hear the same stuff being played. It's a different noise from each car. But there used to be some sort of community, especially with Don and Mike, that I felt that, you know, as I was driving around, there was a ton of other people driving around listening to the same program. I remember laughing out loud, listening to the show, and turning around in traffic and seeing one other person or so laughing. And I assumed it was also from the Don and Mike show.
I feel that's happened to every form of art conceivable. Like, there's no show really anymore, like a Seinfeld. I don't want to use the term water cooler, but you know what I mean? Like, there's very little that people, the next day, they're at work, they're talking about it.
Oh, yes. Everything is fragmented, and it's good because at any time of day, you can find what you want to re-listen to and watch any time of day. Where in before, you know, I would have to watch reruns of Mama's Family just to watch something on TV. But now
please
you can
don't
watch,
knock that. Please don't knock that.
No, well, I won't. I will, but not on air. But now there is a loss of community, I think. I mean, you can see anything you want or listen to anything, but there's no sense of everyone is also listening. So, like, the excitement of it is gone. It's just become very, very personalized.
No, absolutely. There's so much of it I think you can see on Twitter when people are screaming, you know, don't spoil it for me. And you want to think, well, one, just stay the hell off Twitter. But two, if you were watching this live, you know, I'm not the custodian of your DVR
right.
habits here.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like whenever you do anything that upsets someone, it's now your fault, even though you're not in any way. Like, I've done that. I've talked about episodes on Twitter and stuff, and not like 2 minutes after the show, but weeks, and I'll get, you know, angry emails about why did I give it away. It's like, I'm not your daddy. If I want to talk about the twist in Mad Men or whatever, like, how long do I have to wait to be able to do that?
No, I'm with you. I think a great example right now, apparently I've heard there's a lot of twists to Gone Girl, and you know what? I'm just waiting till it's on HBO. I realize I'm playing with fire there. But so be it. I'm an adult.
Well, by the time it's on HBO, it'll be out for a year, right? So, like,
oh, absolutely. Like, I pretty much know whatever's spoilable in that will be spoiled.
Actually, I do know the twist because I read the book, but I won't give it away.
Damn you, you literate bastard.
The book is amazing. I highly suggest you read the book, maybe even before you see the movie.
I've heard nothing but great things about it.
Oh, it's so fantastic. Yeah.
Fine. Maybe I will stoop to that level. I have to ask, you got some names for this book. There's a bunch of guys, and I'm not going to act like I know everyone you got, because you truly are some sort of comedic historian. It's insane.
No, that's not. I don't know everyone I got, but go on.
Well, there was a guy by the name of Henry Beard, the founder of National Lampoon, I believe.
Yes, co-founder, right.
You make him sound harder to get a hold of than Ted Kaczynski, and yet this guy is cutting an interview with you like it's no thing. You have Amy Poehler, Stephen Merchant, a young up-and-comer by the name of Mel Brooks. Maybe you've heard
right.
of him.
Right.
How did you get these guys? Like, in all seriousness.
Well, I have to be honest. A lot. It's very difficult to get all these guys, and it may appear to be easy, but it's not. So sometimes a year's work goes into it. And also, I work at Vanity Fair magazine in New York, so that helps. That name, everyone knows Vanity Fair. Very few people know my name. So, but with the name Vanity Fair, mm-hmm. I think they can trust that I'm not going to screw them or I'm not out to get them in any way. And also what I do is I also make it clear that I will send them back the interview for their final sign-off, that if they're uncomfortable, if they said anything that they don't want published, they can take it out. I don't care about that. And very rarely do they, but it makes them more comfortable. And it allows them to open up, actually, even more than they would otherwise. They don't feel constrained. When you're talking about Henry Beard, he hasn't been interviewed, I don't think, ever at length. And it was just luck of timing, because he had a new book out, which was really great, about 2 years ago. And I asked to interview him about that, and he said yes, which I was surprised about. And then the interview went really well, so then I asked him if we could extend it and put it in the book, and he said yes. But it was just a matter of him finally being able to want to talk about National Lampoon, because it was such a very intense time for him. And
absolutely.
And I
don't want to interrupt, but I really didn't know the name. I believe it's Doug Kenny.
Oh, Doug Kenny. Yeah,
his partner that passed under very suspicious or at least depressing circumstances.
Right. Well, let me explain. Doug Kenny, for those who don't know him, was an extremely talented Harvard Lampoon writer in the late 60s. He wrote the first popular magazine parody of Playboy, and they got the permission from Playboy to do it. Then they wrote a parody of Lord of the Rings called Board of the Rings, and at that point he started with Henry Beard and some others National Lampoon, which became absolutely huge. And then from there he went and co-wrote Animal House. He wrote Caddyshack, and he was known within the industry as just being a genius. You know, everyone loved. He was a comedy writer's comedy writer. He did die in mysterious circumstances in Hawaii. They don't know if he killed himself, he fell off a cliff, or if it was a drug deal gone bad. The vast majority feel that it was suicide. But what happened was in 1980, there was an article in Esquire magazine. Doug Kenny was on the cover. If you can imagine a comedy writer being on the cover of Esquire these days,
he was on the cover.
No. And this is an infamous article, because what it did was it pissed off so many people who were quoted. The journalists got so many quotes incorrect or just plain made them up, allegedly, that it really turned off a lot of comedy writers to talk about National Lampoon for years and years. But at this point, it's 25 years. 35 years, and I think people are over it now. So it was just a matter of timing, and just a matter of getting him at the right moment where he said yes. I mean, but there are plenty of people that I asked who said no, but you just don't hear about those.
Can I hear a few names that said no?
Oh, you name it. I mean, name some.
Oh, Bill Murray.
No.
Okay, that's all I got.
You know, John Schwartzwelder of the Simpsons, he's reclusive. You know, he's written 33 episodes of the Simpsons, and he said no. He's never said yes. I mean, there's a lot of people I would love to get. Albert Brooks, no. Steve Martin, no. Tina Fey didn't want to do it. So
I now think less of all of those people, by the way.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Because,
for you, Mike, for you.
For me,
yes,
sure.
For you.
But to be fair to them, these interviews take up to 20 hours, obviously not at the same same interview session, but they're very, very time, they take a tremendous amount of time, and these people are very busy. So I think, it's understandable to me if they do say no, because this is not an interview for a blog. This is a Playboy-length, Paris Review-length interview that's very intensive.
Yeah, I can see why they balk at it, but they're just so lovingly done, for lack of a better word. You are just incredibly thorough, and you obviously love comedy, and you're interviewing these people because you love their work.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I know. I mean, but I think, quite frankly, most people didn't read the first book. This is the second volume. Maybe that'll change with the third book, if there is one. I don't know. But they're just so packed. Their schedules are so packed. And if it's not an interview for Entertainment Weekly promoting a current movie, they look at it as not being essential publicity. Even though I think, and when I was growing up, the best type of publicity for me were those interviews and books, like the Tom Shales Saturday Night Live book, where they really sat down, they really talked about their whole career and their philosophy and theories of comedy rather than just their latest movie.
I mean, there's so many people, like, again, I considered myself very well versed in comedy, the history of it, and there's people that you talk about, I'm thinking Peggy Lynch really leaps out at me. I had no idea who Peggy Lynch is, and now I'm dying to go and see if I can find any of these Ethel and Albert radio shows online just to listen to. You make the work these people do sound incredible. Like, it just baffles me. I get what you're saying. They can only really cherry pick what they feel are the choicest interviews, but they're lost, dude.
See, that's an interesting example, because here's someone who was 96 when I interviewed her. She's now 97 and still going somewhat strong. But that was a case of her being happy that I got in touch with her, and it was totally by accident. It's not like I knew about her and no one else did.
Mm-hmm.
I asked an expert on early comedy or radio comedy and early TV comedy if any of the old comedy writers were still alive, and he said, I'm not sure. The list I have is a bit old. I went through it 10 to 15 years ago. Go down the list and see if anyone's still alive and capable of talking for hours and hours. So I went down the list, and the only one who was still alive, not just capable, but alive, was Peg Lynch. And she answered the phone, and we ended up talking for an hour. So from that point, then I started doing research on her. And then I was just kind of shocked by the fact that she's really never been interviewed. And she was so really ahead of her time. I mean, she created – some people feel she invented the modern sitcom with a show called Ethel and Albert, which was first on radio, then on TV, which is a very realistic style of comedy. It's not Borscht Belt. It's not Three Stooges or Abbott and Costello. It's very character-based, and it's not like Seinfeld exactly. I mean, obviously you notice differences, but there's a lot of similarities, and Jerry Seinfeld has actually said that he was influenced by this show. So that was just kind of like a lost treasure that was just total luck that it just fell in my lap. But she was happy, because I do think she feels, and I think rightly so, is that she's been forgotten, and she may have been overlooked when it comes to comedy.
No, I believe that's absolutely the case. I mean, the way you describe the show, it's visionary. Like you said, it shied away from the very, I feel at least, with 50 plus years perspective, very corny gags of the time. And it just sounded so, just a humor based in reality.
Right. Like, to give you an example, with Abbott and Costello, it would be all wordplay, and it would be the writers being funny, and maybe create the characters of Abbott and Costello, but it's very broad. Well, now with Ethel and Albert, a sample episode would be Albert coming home from work during Halloween time around that season and wanting to scare Ethel, his wife. So before he comes into the house, he puts on the jack-o'-lantern that's sitting on the porch and comes in and scares her, and she says, get that thing off. I know who it is. It's you just being silly. And then he's unable to get it off, so they have to end up at the emergency room to have it surgically removed, which I think is a great idea. It's very clever. You know, there's another one is sort of similar in that he, to be goofy, puts on his Cub Scout uniform and goes down to the kitchen and are talking, and then he goes off to work, and he took off the uniform but forgot he was wearing his Boy Scout hat so that he had from when he was a kid. So it's just things like that that are very situational-based and very connected with character rather than cleverness that I thought was really ahead of his time.
You've mentioned character a couple times, and I feel shows a lot of times skip on that, and I don't think that's unique to these times. You're not finding a lot of, like, Larry Sanders shows being produced, period. Is that what first spoke to you when you got into comedy? Like, what is it that first drew you into comedy? What was the first comedic product where you're like, oh, my God, I'm in love with this as an art form, period?
Yeah, it was all character-based. I mean, the best comedy, in my opinion, are character-based, whether it's Charlie Chaplin or Woody Allen or Albert Brooks or Steve Martin's character, or the characters they did in SNL, which I loved, or the characters that Chris Elliott would play on Late Night with David Letterman, I was obsessed with. And to me, that's always funnier when you have a fully rounded character coming from an imaginary world that I can think about. I mean, when it's connected to character, I think the jokes are stronger. A lot of the freestanding jokes are funny, but they're just clever. But when there's humanity involved in it and there's in this real life, to me, the comedy becomes deeper. And that's the kind of comedy that I really like. I mean, I like monologue jokes, too. I'm fascinated by writers of that. But to me, what's really interesting is the comedy that is character-based. And that's really the comedy that lasts. You know, gags written 2,000 years ago by Aristophanes aren't funny now, but his plays about real people, and they're really not obviously that much different than us, still are funny to me because it has to do with relationships and striving and ego and not achieving your dreams and all that. So that, to me, remains really fresh. Now, we were talking before we recorded about DC humor, and I was never a fan of Art Buchwald, who had a syndicated column, because what happened, I was a huge fan of comedy. I would walk through the Davis Library in Rockville and look for in the comedy section. And looking at the Art Buchwald compilations when he would do columns from Watergate, you might as well have been looking at something from 1,000 years ago. It was just so dated, and so it didn't connect at all. But I would look at these plays written 1,000 years ago, and it was all character-based, and it was fresher than what Art Buchwald had done just 10 years previous. So
I want to see that on one of his book jackets.
Well, he's passed away, so there'll be no more book jackets. But I mean, he was talented. It just didn't appeal to me, and it was always the character-based stuff that lasted for me, and that still interests me.
It's funny you mention DC comedy in general. I spend a large portion of the show bitching about how I feel there really is no comedy scene here, and you're kind of left sitting here looking up at New York, looking west for, you know, to LA. Even Chicago seems better. I mean, what is there anything you like out of the DC comedy scene, or is it the wasteland that I pretty much portray it to be? And if so, haha, I told you also.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I was growing up, I always looked to New York and LA and Chicago and Toronto. And the DC comedy, I hated. I didn't like Capital Steps, which are a musical parody. Government. Yeah. Or Mark Russell or any of that stuff. But you look at who has emerged out of DC, and Patton Oswalt. Patton Oswalt worked at Waxy Maxy's in Northern Virginia.
That was another failed record store, as I recall, right?
Well, it was around for a long time.
Yeah, I know. It died with the MP3, I guess.
I think, it definitely doesn't exist. I mean, and that was actually, it just sort of imploded. I worked at Kent Mill, and that imploded by the time.
Was there a rivalry there?
Well, that's how I got the interview with Patton Oswalt. I wrote jokingly that I worked at Kent Mill. He worked at Waxy Maxy's. We used to be enemies, but can we bridge our differences and talk about comedy? He was very, very nice and funny, and he said, he said yes to an interview. But for someone like that to emerge out of D.C., I find even just fascinating. But, you know, there was quite a group in the 90s. Dave Chappelle did a lot of performing in D.C., but there's no – it's just a company town, and the business is politics, you know.
Yeah,
so,
it seems a good place to be from in comedy, but not to
remain.
Yeah,
no, not to remain. So the question is, why do you remain?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I remain for what I perceive to be lack of opportunities. Radio is a cruel, cruel mistress, and lately, again, really since that FCC incident, which was, Christ, 10 years ago at this point, radio has been gutted. And
you
so
think,
mobility has really been stripped from the area. You kind of just, whatever station pick you up, you try to work your way through those ranks. But honestly, for me, I don't know. I have a business here, but I'm getting sick of that too. So
what's the business?
I run a locksmith company.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is, I don't know if you have to leave anywhere. You can achieve what you need to achieve anywhere. So I wouldn't feel bad. The reason I ask that is that, like, I feel, yeah, I miss D.C., and I did have to come to New York to work in magazines. But in a lot of ways, I think being where you're from and doing comedy from where you're from is better, because I think you know the area better, and it's more personable, and you don't necessarily have to be, you know, in New York living in an 800-square-foot apartment to put out the type of material that you want to put out now.
Damn it, I need you to romanticize New York a little more. It's what
I will not do that.
Son of a bitch.
It's a jungle, baby.
Well, D.C. is a traffic-laden hellhole now, so it's
it
all
is,
bad.
But so is everywhere. I mean, at least it's a pleasant place to live down there. I really kind of miss it.
Well, are you ever swinging by? I mean, you can certainly drop in the studio.
I would love that, actually. I'm coming down, I think, next month.
Nice. I will be holding you to that. I will actually be up in New York tomorrow.
Oh, I'm gone. I won't be here. Well, why are you coming up?
This is going to sound awful. My girlfriend is obsessed with Lena Dunham.
That does sound awful.
Yeah, she is speaking at, I believe, a Brooklyn bookstore.
Really?
And, yeah, I want to say the tickets were $270 for the pair, and so we will be making a day trip.
$270?
Yeah.
For an book off? That's insane.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, God bless.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the condolences.
Yeah.
I want to get back to poking a dead frog for a bit. The book contains, in addition to what I've said before, these insanely just perfect interviews. They somehow always seem to wind up exactly where they need to. I am incredibly jealous of your technique. But there's it's a rotation of segments. There's also ultra-specific comedic knowledge.
Right.
Which this will shock you, but you get ultra-specific comedic knowledge. For example, Todd Levin of Conan tells the reader how to write a submission packet for late night. And again, going back to Patton Oswalt, you have another segment called Pure Hardcore Advice.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, I feel the book reads like a how-to for a lot of people who might not otherwise know how to get into comedy, like at least giving them hints, giving them tidbits, which I feel are very hard to pick up for a lot of people. I mean, was that like a very conscious thing when you did the book? Okay.
But that's one of the things, too. Like, I grew up in Virginia and Maryland, and comedy writing, show business, writing for magazines, books, that was very, very foreign to me. I didn't know anyone who did it. Didn't know anyone who knew anyone who did it. So I didn't know how to do it. It was very mysterious. It was a different world. And it's not something I was ever taught in high school or college. You know, the writing teachers in college usually have some experience, but it's not with comedy writing. And even publishing it, it's usually with smaller literary magazines than it is with big magazines and books, book publishing. So I don't think it needs to be mysterious. There is a way to do it. There are things you should do and things you should not do, which is just as important, if not more important, because when you do certain things, it keys off the person on the other end. Sometimes it shows them that you're an amateur if you do certain things. So I did want it to be very nuts and bolts. It's like, all right, well, how did you achieve success? How did you do it? And what would you do again differently if you had to do it again? And I thought going straight to those who have achieved success was the best way. And there's a lot of books written by people, a lot of comedy books, who maybe have written one sitcom episode or have done a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But I don't know why they have to be between us, the reader, and the successful comedians and comedy writers. I saw no reason why not to go straight to the source and get it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So, and that was the main reason. And really, the perfect reader for me is someone walking in Davis Library who wants to get into comedy and just has no idea how to do it and stumbles upon this book. And it speaks to them in a certain way.
I don't know if you want to, but can you actually share your journey into all this in terms of, like, what did you do? Because I agree 100%. It's incredibly arcane, like, finding out for a lot of people how to break into this world. And, again, if you want to, get the book. Get it now. I'm going to post multiple links to it on the site and tweet about it and everything. But for you, what exactly, because you said, I think, what anyone who has any comedic aspirations feels, oh, my God, I have zero idea how to get here. So what was it for you? Like, what was step one, two, three?
Yeah, well, I think that's changing now. I think people are, you know, it's less mysterious than it used to be, which is a good thing. But when I was growing up, there were very few outlets. You know, cable wasn't huge. There was a few, you know, popular comedies, late night shows and that. But it was, you know, it was like something on the moon. I just had no idea how to get from point A to point B. So what I did was I just, you know, fumbled my way through it. I didn't know what to do. So after I graduated college, I was living in New Orleans where I went to college, and then I moved back to D.C. area, and I ended up working back at Kent Mill Records.
I was going to ask.
I worked there for a total of 10 years, from 15 to 25. So it was not like I was on the fast track to anything. I just didn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I got my first job, which is a typical D.C. job, which was I was an editor for an association. That's very typical in D.C. For writers and editors. They edit association publications. And this one was very dry, very boring, but it gave me a little bit of editing experience. And from there, I did night editing and weekend editing at a wire service called Night Ritter, which is downtown. And then I was temping at the Washington Post, typing in their ads, literally typing them in. And I snuck into the employment office, which you weren't supposed to do as a temp, and saw that they were hiring an editor for the Syndicate, which syndicated George Will, Jane Bryan Quinn, all those columnists, Richard Cohen, Tom Shales. And they were looking, I saw on the sheet, for an ancient word processing program called Zywrite, which is pre-Microsoft Word. And I just happened to have known that, having done that at Night Ritter.
Sounds like a virus.
Yeah, well, it basically was. But because of that, I was I'm not being modest, it was the only reason I got the job, is I knew Zywrite.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became a Washington Post editorial and working editorial. See, but that's a good lesson, and that's what I learned from that, is that when you open yourself up to possibilities, work as hard as you can, do as much as you can. Like I was doing nights and weekends while having another job, but because I did that, I learned a program that got me into the Washington Post, which then got me into Vanity Fair. So one thing does lead to another, and you have to be very open to experiences, and you have to experience as much as possible. There's nothing to be gained from being kind of reclusive, which I was for a long time, too. You know, you don't meet people. You don't open yourself up to experiences. So from a professional standpoint, from a writing standpoint, nothing can really be gained. So I moved up to New York, worked at Vanity Fair, and from there started freelancing for other magazines and books.
That's incredible to me.
Well, it's just, you know, everyone says this, and it's luck, but there are things that you put yourself into positions where you can find luck. And one of those things I would do a lot earlier, I would surround myself with like-minded people. I wouldn't view it as being a competition, because in the end, it's really who you know, and you really should come up together rather than competing, because there's not much to compete for. It's not that much money. But the person that you may have hung around with as an intern at a magazine, you know, 5 years later, they may be the head of the magazine. So those are the people of your generation that you come up with. And I would, it's just a sense of community. You just meet as many like-minded people as possible. And that can only help your writing, and it can only help your career.
This is a random question. You're just a funny as hell dude. Did you ever have an urge to do stand-up? Like, did you feel hey, I'm funny, I kind of have to do this as a rite of passage? Or did you come from a place where you're like, I can be funny, it doesn't require the stage, I will simply write?
No, I never ever had that hunger. I have done some performing a little bit since then. But
like book readings where you charge $300 for a pair of tickets? God damn it.
That's outrageous. I don't know. Okay, I won't even get into that. But I just find that crazy.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Don't worry, me too.
Okay. Yeah, I've done a lot of readings now and things. I don't really like doing it. I prefer being behind the scenes. I prefer the control of writing. But, you know, for something like this, just talking, I love podcasts and being interviewed on stage or whatever. That's, I love. But I could do without the performing. That doesn't, to me, the writing is the performing from my standpoint.
I'm going to let you go in a minute. God damn, I could drone on with you all day, dude.
Baby.
I have quite the man crush here. I first just want to praise you. The title of the book is, I believe, a E.B. White quote that you have in the introduction. And it reads, humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind. Humor won't stand much poking. It has a certain fragility and evasiveness, which one at best respect. I love the... You titled the book pretty much saying what I'm doing in this cannot be done. The entire concept is you really can't probe humor and get away with it. What the hell? I'm going to do it for like 500 pages anyhow.
Well, no, but that's the thing. I don't really agree with that quote. I mean, I think...
Okay. Then I am a dunce. Continue.
No. But you're right. I mean, I think to poke at it, you're going to ruin the comedy. So I avoided trying to poke at it. And I was being facetious, like here I am with a second volume, still poking that frog.
I got you.
But I do think it can be done. I don't. A lot of the times, in my opinion, it's done too academically. So that's one of the things I wanted to avoid. But I think coming at it and taking myself out of the equation, where I'm not trying to top the comedy writers, which is sort of a pet peeve of mine. And I'm not trying to be funny, just allowing them to be smart and funny and just going straight to the source. Hopefully I avoided the academic aspect of it, and hopefully it can be helpful to those who are just either fans of it or who want to dedicate their careers to it.
It's funny you mention that. I feel it takes a lot of guts to simply – this is going to sound weird because you are interviewing the best of the best in the comedic world – but I still think a lot of people would try to get these jokes in there whenever they could. And I love the fact that you sit back, let these people talk, and just once in a while you get a little something in that gives insight into the fact you're funny as hell. And
well, yeah, thanks. Well, that's a pet peeve. I mean, I see that all the time when someone interviews a comedy writer, and usually inevitably the interviewer is a comedy writer wannabe, so they'll try to outdo the
their chance to shine.
Right. And I, you know, in fact, I always edit out everything that might be construed as me trying to be funny. Every once in a while, maybe once every two or three interviews, I might just leave something in because it would wreck the flow if I brought it out. But I do not want to be the center of attention. I don't, you know, it's they're in the spotlight, not me. And I think and hope that you know, like those great Johnny Carson interviews where Johnny Carson would look great by holding back and letting his guests be funny. I just allow these writers to really shine.
And that actually is, I'm going to stick up for you a little bit here. Speaking of pet peeves with people trying to be funny when they shouldn't, et cetera, I feel everyone who gave you a quote, and God bless them, they did you a huge service, but I am very, very just straight up gay for Bob Odenkirk.
Oh,
and the fact that I feel every other guy, and I'm not going to mention any names whatsoever except Bob's, I feel almost everyone else tried to give this quippy little recommendation, you know, and bits of praise for the book that are all over the jacket. And again, they're awesome for doing it. But Bob just came out and said, no one generates more interesting, revealing, or entertaining interviews than Mike Sacks. Poking a dead frog is a classic. And again, there's just something so ballsy about a dude who's funny as hell, and he's like, I don't have to be funny all the time.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's Bob Odenkirk. He's amazing.
This is Mike's time.
Yeah, well, the thing is, too, a lot of those people who gave me blurbs didn't even read the book. So that's their way of saying, okay, I'll give the publisher a blurb, but I don't even know how good it is. So I'll be a little quippy. But Bob read the book, so he felt he could be, I guess, honest. But that's just who he is, too. I mean, that comes out in his comedy, which is so brilliant, is that he doesn't give a shit if it comes off as earnest or as character-based or any of that. He just does what he wants to do. He's just a real individual. No, I love the fact that he gave that quote. It just meant a lot to me.
He's incredible. When I was younger, I was obsessed with Mr. Show, and I was totally on Dave Cross's jock out of the two. And as time goes on, every day I'm just like, what the hell was I thinking? Clearly Bob was the man here.
Yeah, I know. Well, he is a comedic genius, and everything he's been associated with, even by proxy, even the shows like Tim and Eric or the Birthday Boys or any of that, like that's him bringing those shows to light. And that's not to say anything against David Cross, who's an amazing stand-up, but Bob Odenkirk is almost like a student of comedy. He knows everything about comedy, and he's also incredibly open to new comedy. So he's not shutting himself in his room watching old Mr. Show DVDs. He's really out there and finding stuff that he really loves and then being a mensch and talking up these people and giving them shots, which is very, very rare. It doesn't happen too often, but he's just a really special guy.
He is. I'm so in love with the fact that he's finally getting his due with Better Call Saul. Like, I am praying that thing does 10 seasons. I want it to be the Frasier to Breaking Bad's Cheers. Like,
I don't know. My feeling is it's going to be amazing. That's just my feeling. What he's said so far and from what I've heard about the show, I think it's going to be a combination of funny and horrific and just amazing. And I'm really excited. I think it comes out in February. And I watch very, very little TV at this point, but like this is a show I cannot wait to see. I think he's going to be fantastic.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Before I let you go, I actually did want to ask, like, what are you currently obsessed with? I don't know, it's kind of a exaggerated word for it, but what are you loving comedically? Like,
well, one of the, I mean, I love, Breaking Bad. I thought that was a combination of comedy and horror, which I've never quite seen before. The Sopranos I found funny, too, but I actually prefer Breaking Bad to The Sopranos. One of the things I love is a show that was on the radio called The Best Show on FMU.
Okay.
And it was with Tom Sharpling, who was the host, and it would be a three-hour weekly show, and 2 hours of that would be music and calls and things of that sort. And usually, not every week, but most weeks, he would have these calls with a performer, John Worster, who's a comedic performer. He's also the drummer for Bob Mould and the Mountain Goats and some other bands. So he's an amazing musician, an amazing performer. And they would do these characters week after week over a series of like 10, 15 years where they would create an entire world called Newbridge, New Jersey. And just really getting in depth about that world, about the characters, about their backstories. And it's the most astonishing thing. Now, he's no longer on WFMU, Tom Sharpling, but he's about to begin his own podcast. But every one of his shows is on the WFMU website. So you can literally listen to 15 years of shows, comedy shows that these guys have done. And I just think it's astonishing.
And he says WFMU's website?
Yeah, WFMU.org.
Okay. I will have to give that a look-see.
Yeah, check it out.
Mike, I feel I should let you go at this point.
No, this was fun. I love talking with people from my home turf.
If you could come in studio, dude, I had an incredible time. If you want to come in studio anytime.
How bad is the traffic around the studio? Is it right off the...
It's about, I want to say, 2 miles outside of the Beltway.
Mm-hmm.
There's times where it's light. I don't know. I can give you the little windows you could sneak in here.
Yeah, I think I know them unless they've closed since I've been down there. I mean, I always used to, if I could, travel between like 10 and 3. And then after that, the Pentagon would get out and that would muck up. Yeah.
It's been shaved down to about 11 to 2 at this point.
Oh, my God. Wow. So that's my window. All right, I'll come down from New York and I'll land between 11 and 2 and we can figure something out.
I would love that. People, please buy this book. Again, I'm going to put the link out wherever I can. Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. If you want to follow Mike on Twitter, it's at Michael B. Sachs, and the website is MikeSachs.com. Oh, and one last thing. I love the fact that you are using the image of John Hamm.
Yeah.
Wherever possible in the about the author. It is just John Hamm at the typewriter and very dryly at the end talking about Mike Sachs. He is not pictured here.
Right. Well, I should explain. I didn't want to be photographed. I'm not going to sell one book through my face, but I figured if I could get someone famous to play the character of a comedy writer, a frustrated comedy writer, it might be able to sell more. And luckily, John Hamm is a big fan of comedy, and he posed for hours for free one weekend for a friend of mine who's a photographer, and I just thought it was so nice. But the photo author photo in my book is John Hamm as a frustrated comedy writer.
Your Twitter photo as well, by the way.
Oh, I use it on my driver's license. I'll use it anywhere. You know, think John Hamm trying to look bad is 100% better than me all gussied up.
Oh, he's still glorious.
He's a great-looking guy and a great person. So I'm sure he wouldn't even be happy with me doing this, but like I'm posting his photo on all my sites, Facebook, Twitter, you know, wherever I need to put my own face, John Hamm's goes up. And he can't blame me for that, quite frankly, right?
The worst thing is on Twitter, it took me forever to give it your picture more than a passing glance. But whenever I would at first, I'm like, that handsome bastard.
Yeah, what a handsome dude. What is he doing writing?
Exactly.
And meanwhile, you should see what I look like in reality. So the fact that John Hamm is my public face is the best.
Oh, God. You're killing me, dude. All right, Mike, I can't thank you enough. I guess I'll stop the recording here and then, you know, give you a little blowy when the
All right, man.
Guy.
Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I'll talk with you soon.
All right, man. Mike, thanks again.
No problem. Take care.
All right. Once again, a huge thank you to Mike Sachs for taking the time to come on the show. Please do yourself a favor. I'm not just doing this because the guy is really, really nice and down to earth. His book, Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. If you're at all into comedy, if you fancy yourself a student of comedy, any of that stuff, it's just an incredible read with names that you're familiar with, names that you didn't know, but the instant you read about them, you're like, God damn it, I have to get on knowing that. Please, again, Poking a Dead Frog. It can be found Amazon, you know, Kindle editions, all that good stuff. Just get it quickly. If you want to get a hold of Mike on Twitter, it's at Michael B. Sachs, and his website is MikeSachs.com. I'm John Papagiorgio of Papa's Basement. That's all we have time for this episode. You want to get a hold of me for whatever reason, trust me, get a hold of Mike instead of me. He's much, much funnier and better in all ways as a human being as well as a comedic talent. But if you still want to slum it up, I am over at inpapasbasement.com. It's at Papa's Basement on Twitter. And find the show Papa's Basement on iTunes and Stitcher, as well as Papa's Football Podcast. And if you're into the comic thing at all, you can go to thespookiescomic.com. I write that as well. All right. Again, Mike, thanks. All right. We're out of here.
We're home free. School's out, baby.
Good show.
Nothing to talk about. Nothing to critique. Great show. Great guest tomorrow. You go home, have a glass of wine, whack off. I'll see you tomorrow.
That's the post-show critique?
Yeah. You're the best.
It's my time to go. I successfully burned all my bridges. Nobody loves me, and I don't love nobody.
Then he said penis.
Then he said masturbation.
Then he said vagina. That was cool.
Had a mighty hard time, but I'm on my way. Had a mighty hard time, but I'm on my way. It's a mighty hard climb, but I'm on my way. On my way.